Welcome to Vox Talks, a series of audio interviews with leading economists from around the world. My name is Ramesh Vaitalingam, and today's interview is with Danny Roderick, who is Professor of International Political Economy at the Harvard Kennedy School at Harvard University. Danny and I met at the American Economic Association's annual meetings in New Orleans in January 2008, where we spoke about his research on the role of institutions in economic development.
Well, about 15 years ago, it was all about getting prices right, and now it's all about institutions. So that's sort of we're at the that's the new frontier in thinking about development. I think that's good, but I think it's sort of created a number of new blind spots, and I think is bringing back some of the. Bad old habits of the Washington Consensus as well. So it's under the old Washington Consensus, we thought what countries needed to do, we already knew them. It was just lack of political will. We thought that these reforms pretty much the same across the world. And third, that we sort of felt at least implicitly that even if countries couldn't do them all at the same time, the more they did, the better. I actually think that none of those three things is right. That we have a lot of countries that are growing very rapidly without extensive institutional reform. So clearly, what is required to ignite economic growth and get sort of private sector dynamism going and private investment up is not sort of institutional reform in a broad across the board sense, but institutional reform that's much more narrowly targeted at what is the binding constraint of the moment. Just to give an example from my presentation this morning, if you go to Africa and sort of talk to firms, everybody will complain about how inefficient the court system is and how you can't rely on the judiciary. You would immediately conclude that the contract enforcement environment is so poor this is a major obstacle holding back private sector growth in Africa, and judicial reform is an urgent priority. And you would observe that what firms are doing, because they can't rely on courts, is essentially a system of relational contracting, that they have long-term trust-based relationships with their customers and suppliers, and a whole bunch of associated strategies that go with sort of repeated game type of incentives. But then when you go to a country like Vietnam, which has been growing at 9% in the last few years, and with private investment is more than 30% of GDP, is attracting a huge amount of trade and investment, you find that the formal contract enforcement environment is, if anything, worse than in most countries in sub-Saharan Africa. Fewer firms, a smaller proportion of firms in Vietnam say that they can actually rely on the court system than they can in most countries in sub-Saharan Africa. Firms follow exactly the same kind of strategies in Africa in terms of relation contracting, repeated interactions with suppliers and so forth. So obviously, in the case of Vietnam, the weakness of the judiciary, the weakness of the court system, has at least so far not been a binding constraint on economic growth. Example and many more suggest that we can't simply jump from an observation that the formal institutions, in this case the court system, is poor, that's necessarily something that's blocking growth, and that is something that needs to have urgent priority in terms of reform. So that's one broad point, is the need to target the institutional reforms on the priorities rather than sort of taking an across the board extensive view of it. Another point is to think about economic and institutional reform in a second best with a second best frame of mind, rather than with a sort of a first best or best practices kind of mind. So just to take an example from another area, if you're interested in getting the an economy to open up, to globalize, to orient itself outward, the kind of sort of best practices in that area would involve things like having very low and uniform import tariffs, no quantitative restrictions on imports, becoming a member of the WTO and you know, working within those rules and so forth. And yet, when we look at who have been the most successful globalizers, which have been the countries that have most rapidly, most successfully turned outward, it would be countries like South Korea and Taiwan in the 60s and 70s. It would be a country like China in the late 1970s and 1980s. It would be, again, Vietnam since the late 1980s, none of whom actually followed this sort of best practice model of outward orientation. Instead, what they each did was achieve outward orientation through highly heterodox policies and institutional arrangements. The East Asian countries like South Korea and Taiwan relied extensively on export subsidization while keeping protected markets at home. China, of course, relied on special economic zones and a whole range of export subsidies that were mostly not transparent. Other cases like Southeast Asian countries have relied significantly on export processing zones and investment subsidies for foreign multinationals. And you say, so why is it that you have these different sort of strategies? And I think one explanation is that that you need to protect employment in the transition to outward orientation, and that across-the-board import liberalization tends to pull the rug from underneath many of the formal enterprises and therefore result in a contraction in formal sector employment before you have sufficient new export-oriented economic activities that are stimulated, that are that can then absorb this employment that's released from the previously protected formal sector. And I think the advantage of the kind of strategies that these successful globalizers have pursued is to achieve outward orientation while ensuring that in the transition employment was being sufficiently protected. And instead, in Latin America, what you had was a huge explosion in informality because the previously protected firms, in order to become more productive and compete in the world economy, they essentially shed a lot of labor. And this labor didn't end up going into export-oriented firms. They ended up feeding the informal sector. So you have the paradox that these import-competing firms have now become significantly more productive, but the economy as a whole has not become productive because labor has moved from sort of moderately productive activities to even less productive activities rather than moving to even the more productive activities. So it's understanding how labor market issues and learning and productive dynamism interacts with your institutional reforms is a key aspect of this. So those are the kind of issues that I think institutional reform has to take into account, and which I think often sort of our sort of best practice frame of mind ignores.
I mean, your central message is really encapsulated in the title of your recent book, One Economics, Many Recipes. You were saying that there is no single route that a country should follow.
Right.
There's no right.
But I think I hope it's a little bit more than that, and that in the sense that I think it's the danger with the message that there is not a single route is that the message that people take is therefore everything goes. What I'm trying to argue is not that everything goes, that in fact economics as a science has a lot to contribute in disciplining the discussion about how you actually take the next step, which is to say, I know I want to achieve better contract enforcement and better output orientation. Now, how do I think about the strategies that are available for them? And this is then economics, which is a science of understanding what the trade-offs are and how you can get the right incentives, is incredibly important. And then when you apply economics, what you learn is not that everything goes, it's just that you need to tailor what you're going to be doing to the reality that you've inherited.
Yes, because you've used the term growth diagnostics, which is kind of a scientific term to approaching and analysing the position of a particular country, isn't it?
That's right. So that's you know, I hesitate to say it's science because it's not, but it's more the craft of learning how to apply economics systematically and learning how to apply empirical analysis systematically understand where the binding constraints might be, so where you can target your reform efforts for a better bang for the buck, and B, how you can design policy and institutional reforms that are that have a much better chance of working given what you've already inherited.
Can we talk about applying this to a particular country? You've done work on South Africa recently, I understand. I mean, how have you gone about thinking about applying this approach to understanding South Africa's prospects for growth?
That's right. For the last 2 years, we've been working along with colleagues from Harvard, MIT, and elsewhere, trying to apply this kind of framework to South Africa. And it's interesting because it's the notion of applying growth diagnostics and the need to think in terms of binding constraints has had tremendous amount of appeal, and this type of terminology now is being used in a whole lot of settings and by a lot of governments and increasingly within the World Bank and so forth. And the demand for doing this came from the South African government, much of the initial groundwork was actually done by them, which is exactly how it should be. I think this is not something that a bunch of outsiders come and do for you. It's something that hopefully is a way of thinking that you internalize and then try to do it on your own. So this has been a process of interacting with our South African colleagues and the South African government in trying to sort of get them to think much more explicitly about where the binding constraints might be. And it's been an interesting experience both because of some of the agreements that we've had as well as some of the disagreements that we've had. I think the key issue in South Africa is the very high rate of unemployment, particularly among young black males. That unemployment rate is somewhere around, is higher than 40%. So if there is a binding constraint in South Africa, it's clearly lack of employment demand for relatively unskilled black males. And the issue is how you're going to create that employment demand. And we've been working on formulating a set of approaches that range all the way from labor market interventions to trade policies to industrial policies to a more conducive macro policy environment. One area where I think we've had a bit of disagreement, and I think this is again illustrates the usefulness of applying the diagnostic tools, is because it helps structure a dialogue around the issues. Under what kind of facts on the ground would your story be correct, and would your diagnosis be more applicable than mine? So I think even when we have that differences in views, I think it still helps the dialogue. A specific example I have in mind is the degree to which the shortage of skilled workers is constraining the economic growth in South Africa. I think there is a widespread perception and feeling in South Africa among businesses and within the government that lack of skills is a significant constraint on South Africa's economic growth. It's also reflected, incidentally, in the in firm surveys that when firms are asked whether what is really constraining their growth, lack of skills is one of the most frequently cited factors. In our work, what we found is that there is a sense in which this is overstated, because the complaint about lack of skills reflects the existing and highly skewed structure of the economy. Whereas, as I've said before, what is only going to create employment and sustainable growth in South Africa is actually a pattern of growth that's going to be much more closely aligned with the existing set of factor endowments, which is highly unskill intensive, than on a skill intensive model. And I think the reason that there is a lot of complaints about lack of skill is that the sectors that have been predominantly expanding over the last decade or so in South Africa have been the skill-intensive sectors, particularly finance, insurance, and related economic activities, which absorb a lot of skilled workers. So if you ask sort of the existing firms, you know, which have been successful, where do you see the constraints and where the loudest complaints are, is in the area of skills. But if you ask, is this the kind of model that's actually going to generate growth in South Africa? It's highly unlikely, because the only way you can generate enough jobs in tradable and export-oriented sectors is going to be to absorb the low-skilled workers that you actually are not creating jobs for. And that means putting the focus much more on those kinds of jobs and not necessarily on skills. So this has been an ongoing discussion.
So moving back to the broader issue, where have we got to with the program of research that your colleagues have been working on in terms of its acceptance amongst the sort of the development community? Have we said goodbye to the Washington consensus?
Oh, I think that's without question, the answer to that one is yes. I think the Washington consensus is dead for all practical purposes. And I think, you know, the terminology of binding constraints in growth diagnostics has been extremely influential and successful in the sense of it's cropping up in all kinds of places I would least expect, including speeches by the managing director of the fund. Whether that set of ideas have received acceptance, I think certainly the notion of, being much more diagnostically oriented, being much more selective, being much more country-specific, and focusing on finding constraints rather than across the board. I think there we have won that particular battle. Where there's a lot more work to be done is in terms of just understanding and improving how that methodology is actually applied, because often we find that language is being used, but then the output of that process is something that's entirely undisciplined by how we would like to see that framework applied. But that sort of, that particular craft, I think needs to be developed much more. So there's a lot more work to be done in that area. The second area where, where I've worked a lot and question might be posed as to whether it's received acceptance is the question of industrial policy. Because increasingly I found that a lot of these countries, what sort of the Washington consensus mentality has shunted aside, is the need for some kind of explicit industrial policy. And I think that also is becoming a little bit more accepted, although here it's becoming accepted in practice rather than in terminology, because I think nobody wants to use the term industrial policy anymore, because that's sort of just a bad word. But in practice, industrial policy is all over the place. So the question there is becoming how to improve what governments are already doing. And then probably where my ideas, I would have to say, sort of become least accepted, it's still probably some of the writings I've done on sort of globalization, and in particular the notion that a better global governance of the inter-
international economic system is going to require much greater policy space. Now, I think some of my earlier work on the need for social safety nets as the flip side of the coin for more open economies, I think that's become thoroughly conventional wisdom now. So that's, but more recent work that where I've been trying to argue that we need a better balance between the international economic liberalization and the space for countries to pursue their own domestic social and growth agendas. There I see a lot more resistance. So that's in some senses the next frontier for me.
Daniel Roderick, thank you very much.
Thank you.